Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
In talking to farmers today, you talked to a soybean farmer who didn't have any rain past July 1 and still had a pretty good yield. And it just didn't used to happen. And they really credit a lot of that to the development of new varieties.
Andy Levine is CEO, American Seed Trade Association.
We're going to continue to see that improvement as the discovery continues to happen. So that's really exciting. And as we deal with Mother Nature, climate change, and evolving pest and disease, we've got to have those tools in our toolbox. So need to make sure that the government doesn't overburden breeding to the point that it becomes very limited just to a few crops. And so that's our focus as we go forward. And that's what our crystal ball looks like.
This is Agriculture Today.
So the Sorghum Quality Report, this will actually be the fifth edition that we have published.
Jace Hafner is Manager of Global Trade with the U.S. Grains Council.
Something that we do every marketing year to try to demonstrate consistency, even despite harsh growing conditions to overseas buyers. But really, other than the physical traits and the chemical composition of the sorghum that's tested, the main takeaway from this report is to show that U.S. sorghum is completely tannin-free. And that really is the most unique marketing advantage that U.S. sorghum has that's most applicable to feed grain application for our overseas buyers.
Why is the report important?
Well, I will say when we go speak with our overseas buyers, and obviously our number one customer is China, they already know that U.S. sorghum is the best quality in the world relative to other origins. But it is important for us to document all of this and have unbiased testing done on it so they can show, so we can show year to year that U.S. sorghum meets the grading requirements for number one overwhelmingly, as well as that it is tannin-free, which, like I said, is the key determining factor or determining marketing advantage that U.S. sorghum has over other origins.
And despite variance in weather...
So we generally see the quality is very consistent year to year with sorghum production. I think that speaks to, number one, the durability of sorghum as a crop, as well as to the professionality of the U.S. sorghum producer. But even in previous years, given 2021 and 2022, we experienced significant drought. There is no impact in the quality overall. Very, very little impact, very little measured damage, and, you know, relatively similar levels of protein, starch, and oil and feed value overall. So, no, it just does speak to sorghum's durability as a crop.
And Hafner says it may sound boring, but the key takeaway is...
You know what? The report looks very similar year to year, and that is the highlight. The highlight is that it's overwhelmingly consistent, even despite drought, despite heat, and despite difficult growing conditions. Definitely, the main takeaway is that it is consistent year over year, and that's really what the Sorghum Quality Report is supposed to demonstrate.
And before China came along, Mexico was the number one buyer.
So the buyers in Mexico are very price dependent, given that U.S. sorghum generally trades at about 150% the price of U.S. corn. We see these Mexican buyers purchasing opportunistically. So China is the number one overseas buyer, and then below that is Mexico, but the difference between that is 17-fold. So that just puts into perspective how much the Chinese are buying. And the, you know, the buyers in northern Mexico will really swoop in when it's a price convenience for them. So we are still active in the Mexican market, and we are still trying to incentivize or, you know, reinforce the notion that U.S. sorghum is equal to the feed value of corn. We try to drive those purchases. And really, like I said, the Chinese buying all of it is a good problem to have. We have buyers all over the world literally cold calling our office, asking where it is and where it's all going and why the price is so high. And so it's just our job at the U.S. Grains Council to keep developing those secondary markets and not thinking of it as a race to the bottom should the Chinese leave the market, as a race to the top, and focusing on not only the feed grain market but other value-added markets. Pet food in Mexico and all of Latin America, for example, is a target market for U.S. sorghum producers. And so we'll continue to reinforce that notion.
But the bottom line, why does this matter to a farmer?
So, you know, uniquely, most of the U.S. coarse grains are kind of in the same boat in the international space. We really are all more expensive than our competitors. So the work that we're doing at the U.S. Grains Council for corn and sorghum, as well as distillers, grains, barley, and ethanol, is to really reinforce purchasing on feed value or end-use value instead of just the face cost value. And I think that's very important work that the U.S. Grains Council is doing and will really help drive demand for our products overseas.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Things are daunting is probably an optimistic way of describing the situation.
Alan Auerbach is a professor and economist at University of California, Berkeley. He says the future is never smooth. And when it comes to the nation's debt...
So I'm just going to highlight a few of these things in my comments in terms of thinking about it. Because so when we look at the, you know, we hear everything Phil said, but when we look at that picture that he had up at the end of the debt rising smoothly, we sort of forget that that's a, you know, projections always are smooth. History is never smooth, and that should tell us something about the future.
Still, we make projections about the future. What are his final thoughts?
The final point I wanted to make has to do with shocks and that smooth projection, which you see here. So here's historical debt to GDP, and then the projections. This is, you know, it's a different color, but it's basically the graph that Phil was showing you in terms of the projected debt to GDP ratio. And I wanted to make an observation, which is, if you were to describe sort of what shocks to the economic situation caused the debt to move significantly, it's, you know, you would describe the path here as one where, in good times, at least since the you know, early 2000s, so you look at the last 22, 23 years since the, you know, end of the dot-com bust recession. In good times, the debt to GDP ratio just doesn't move very much. You might have hoped that it would go down with good growth and no negative shocks. And that would have been true in the 1950s. But since there's so much underlying push upward through entitlement programs, for example, that keeps you from gaining any ground. And so the debt to GDP ratio just sort of, in good times at full employment, just sort of stays constant. And then when you have a recession, things really go badly. And in our last two recessions, which admittedly were not garden variety recessions, neither of them, we've had sharp increases in the debt to GDP ratio. And after each one, debt to GDP ratio just stays constant after that. And then you have a shock, and it stays constant. So you might think that things can be worse than projected, things can be better than projected, and given that those things would sort of balance, that the trajectory that the baseline is showing of the debt to GDP ratio just sort of smoothly going up is a pretty good guess. But I think that's wrong. I think the way to think about it is that if things go well, remember, CBO doesn't project, they don't predict recessions. So that rising debt to GDP ratio, that's good times. That's not sort of average times. That's good times. And so if that happens, we're not even going to be staying constant the way we have after recent recessions. The debt to GDP ratio is going to be going up. So it's either going to be going up or it's going to be going up a lot. And those are really the two possibilities. And given that, Phil may need to rethink that ceiling of 250% for his graphs, because otherwise he's going to have a footnote explaining why the end of the series is cropped from the picture.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Our committee has considered several bills that would support an improved wildfire response network, from increasing the use of technology for wildfire detection to integrating the local communities, loggers, and volunteer firefighters into wildfire suppression efforts on federal land.
Recent hearing on the FY25 budget request for the Forest Service, Chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, Joe Manchin.
In the meantime, Congress has tried to address this problem at the source by investing heavily in hazardous fuels reduction. Between the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and the Inflation Reduction Act, the Forest Service has been given about $12 billion on top of your annual appropriations. Now that we're a few years into those laws, today is a good opportunity for us to take a stock of how the Forest Service is implementing those historic investments, as well as the proposed budget for the fiscal year 2025.
Testifying on behalf of the administration, Forest Service Chief Randy Moore. But Manchin from West Virginia says timber is wasting away.
One is that, you know, when we try and have large timber sale projects to recoup the salvage, many times we get litigated on that. And even where we are litigated, many times...
Who litigates? Why would they litigate? Because you can reforest, you can basically cut and salvage and reforest at the same time.
Mr. Chairman, I know, you know, with our democratic process and the fact that we're a public agency, 300 million people can...
Someone's upset, right?
Yeah, and so our challenge is, as we go through the litigation to defend why we're wanting to do what we want to do, winning is not the answer. Delaying these salvage sales long enough so that they begin to lose value so that they're not worth purchasing after a period of time. And depending on where you are, blue stain sets in, which reduces the value of the wood. The challenge we have is that how do we remove a lot of that timber in a really quick way? And so our approach has been to take small pieces of that and to do what we can to remove the timber while it has value.
Let me ask one more question. 25 mills, around 25 mills have shut down this year near our federal forests, including several in my own home state of West Virginia. I know the reasons for the shutdowns vary, but I'm concerned about the impact they're going to have on rural communities, as well as the impact on carrying out the Forest Service management goals. So what authorities do you have to ensure a consistent supply of federal timber and give these sawmills some ability to weather the current market volatility?
So we've been working with a lot of the sawmills. In fact, we've been looking at wood innovations. And over the last 3 years, we invested $79 million specifically to sawmills and to the industry to help them transition while this is going on in our country. And so we
the only way they're going to transition is basically have access to the product.
Well, they're market-driven conditions that they are responding to, which also has an impact on whether they are interested in a lot of the timber sales on national forests. When you look at the economy in and of itself, it's moving away from paper products. So that has a negative impact on some of the mills that produce that type of material. When you look at small diameter, low value type material, most of our facilities use the large commercial saw logs. And so a part of what we want to do is to help and work with industry to transition to have a more diversified portfolio, if you will, and look at some of the products, biofuel, biochar, nanocellulosis material, cross-laminated timber. These are the types of technology that's emerging, but our infrastructure in general is not set up to use that type of material in abundance. And so we are trying to work with industry to transition to that. And I think that you're going to see some really interesting things come from industry sometime later this summer. I do think that they're making the adjustment.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
From the week of June 10th, the U.S. Grains Council will be hosting its third annual Global Starch Conference. The last year we had done it in Seoul, South Korea, but this year we're going to be doing it in Chicago, Illinois.
Alexander Grabois is the manager of Global Strategies and Trade with the U.S. Grains Council.
And we'll host about 40 international buyers, both on the technical side, so your plant managers, technical experts, as well as procurement managers for plants around the world. So we have markets covered everywhere from China, South Korea, to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, Peru. So we're all over the map. And the general idea is to highlight what we've been doing is the work with Dr. Vijay Singh and the University of Illinois. We've had some lab research that shows the higher starch extractability of U.S. corn, while also helping show how to improve yields or improve profitability. And then this year, what we're looking to do that's a little bit different is also highlight the procurement side. So one of the things that we saw as a challenge, as a healthy challenge, is how do we get our procurement managers overseas to see the same thing that the technical managers see? Because many times purchasing is done off of a least cost. So wherever the price is more favorable, that's what they'll go with. But we want to convince our buyers and our national partners that what you should really be looking for is value. So essentially a value-based procurement strategy that would highlight the return on investment and performance of their product should be essentially the driver. So we're going to touch on topics such as sustainability, PS&D, market outlooks, also procurement strategies, procurement practices, and also hearing from producers. We feel that this is a great one-stop shop in a way, and really being able to impact the starch industry both globally and domestically, where we'll have a presence.
spent a lot of research in poultry and starch.
Well, in this case with global starch, we're looking more on the wet milling side. So, well, you'll see a lot of the corn gluten feed, corn gluten meal. But the same reasons why we see higher yields in the industrial starch industry, which is due to the softer endosperm and easier millability and ability to break down, this also translates to the poultry industry. So we had been doing some studies with a few different partners, Auburn University, Northern Crops Institute, and some of our members such as the North Dakota Corn Board, South Dakota, as well as Minnesota. And what we found is that U.S. corn also has superior performance in the poultry industry due to a more favorable feed conversion rate. So that means a bird through a growth period will be able to consume less feed, but still have that same growth and really be able to maximize its efficiency. So we feel that that can have essentially from the poultry side all the way to the final consumer, you'll see a big impact.
He also talks about other research, especially on cracked kernels and the look of the crop.
We always like to follow the trends. One thing that I like to do is work with our international offices and see what comments they've been receiving from our international partners as far as grain quality is concerned, or really seeing how we can work together to change the perception on U.S. corn. One of the comments that we get a lot is that U.S. corn maybe looks a little dusty, it breaks a little easier. But through these projects, what we want to do is really show that the same reason why it maybe breaks a little easier is why it performs better, and how that can make more money for international plants or partners, and also just be a more effective option. So we've been trying to see how we can roll out some of these projects, using the Global Starch Conference as a great driver for that, same with our poultry study, and just really continue to develop our market.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In terms of where we're going, this is what's happened in the last year. Phil talked about the good news between the spring of 2023 and the spring of 2024 in terms of the CBO forecast, largely due to reductions in projected spending.
Talking about the nation's debt, Alan Auerbach is a professor and economist at UC Berkeley.
This was the bad news in the change, which was the increase in the interest rate being projected going forward this year relative to last year, which is higher. But the other thing to keep in mind and what to look for in the next version of the CBO baseline is this, which is the market year on 10-year treasuries since the beginning of 2024 until last week. And it's really gone up substantially. Now, of course, 10-year yields are only one component of the interest of the debt service because of there's a maturity structure of the national debt. But this is obviously not going to be good news in terms of what the next CBO forecast tells us about debt service. It's going to be a lot higher, taking account also of the fact that government spending is going to be higher because the CBO baseline is just generally very optimistic about what is happening to discretionary spending. And as Phil mentioned, in recent weeks, we've had two major shocks upward in the defense bill and in student debt relief. And one has to assume that more of the same is coming in both of those areas, if not in other areas as well. And that's going to make discretionary spending, the path of discretionary spending, at least over the next several years, much higher than has been projected in the most recent CBO baseline.
Referencing the numbers from the Congressional Budget Office, where does all of this end?
First of all, I think for Japan especially, you need to be careful about the difference between the gross and the net debt. Japan has all the numbers that Phil showed you are net, that is, it's publicly held debt. And in Japan, I think an even larger share of the national debt is held internally within the government. And so it's still much higher than it is in the U.S., but I don't think it's quite as high as sometimes suggested. The other thing I wanted to say about all this is, in terms of where it ends, I usually think of the quote by Rudy Dornbusch, a famed international economist, which is that crises take longer than you expected to happen, and then they happen faster than you expected. And that's not very helpful in terms of talking about how far we can go, but I don't think one can be sanguine about things being calm, that it'll take a while for them to unravel, because I think once they start unraveling, they can unravel pretty quickly. But I think one of the things that's causing interest rates to go up is, in Fed terminology, the fact that our star is probably higher than we were thinking a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. The natural rate of interest, where the Fed is going to be setting the federal funds rate to keep it, have a non-inflationary position. And we were thinking a few years ago, we thought about secular stagnation and the big decline in the natural rate of interest, the Fed calls our star. I have a sense that there's a general consensus in the profession that we probably overdid it in terms of thinking it had declined. And so it's certainly true that confidence in fiscal responsibility would help keep interest rates down, but I don't think we're going to get as much of a bonus from low interest rates as we got a few years ago.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Congress passed the Utah Wilderness Act in 1984, product of a long, protracted, hard-fought compromise made by the state of Utah, and it's something that designated wilderness in exchange for assurance that no future Utah wilderness designations would be made.
Talking to Forest Service Chief Randy Moore, Senator Mike Lee from Utah.
Now, the Forest Service appears to be ignoring this history, and both the state and the individual county resource management plans applicable to that area. The only way we get healthy forests is by having flexibility to perform active management of the forests. It turns out, as we've learned over the last few decades, you let the thing just go. That's terrible for forest health. What we're dealing with throughout Utah is this patchwork of designated wilderness, recommended wilderness, and inventoried roadless areas that make active management a nightmare. And frankly, practically unachievable. These updated forest plans will only make the situation worse as you've got them drafted. Can you explain how these new wilderness recommendations were developed and why the state and local counties' input was apparently disregarded completely in the preferred alternative?
Yeah, so the forest supervisor is planning to meet with the county supervisors to cooperate on that forest plan issue.
And how'd that go?
It hasn't taken place yet. They are scheduled to have a meeting to discuss this very issue that you're bringing up. We'll be happy to let you know how they go once the meeting takes place.
Yeah, after the draft plan was released, but before that, it apparently didn't happen that way. I don't know why I should have any assurance that it'll go any better now. Now, look, every single state official and county commissioner that I talk to seems to be increasingly frustrated with the way that the Forest Service manages Forest Service land. All these local officials ask for is a real seat at a real table in these important decisions that have to be made, decisions that affect us, our local communities, very directly, much more directly than they do anybody else. We all want healthy forests, and we all want to avoid catastrophic wildfires, but the consequences of bad policy hit some of us a lot more than they hit others. For example, in both the Ashley and the Manti-LaSalle proposals, the Forest Service appears willing to enter into co-management arrangements with tribes, but it refuses to incorporate state and county comments into the planning process. If the Forest Service can enter co-management arrangements with the tribes, why exactly can't it enter into similar arrangements with county governments and the state government?
Senator, we do honor the county governments, and we do work with them same as we work with tribes. In fact, we probably work more with the county governments than we do tribes.
With co-management, the same way you got it with the tribes?
No, it's
not been my experience.
Yeah, well, you know, tribes are sovereign nations, so we deal with them differently than...
States also are sovereign. They are co-sovereigns. States are co-sovereigns, and tribes also have their own elements of co-sovereignty.
Senator, we deal with the counties, and we work with the counties. They have a seat at the table, and I'm not sure... I'm not sure we're not doing just exactly what you're saying, because...
Well, I'm certain that you're not. I'm certain that you're not. Look, the 2001 Roadless Rule establishes prohibition on road construction and on timber harvesting on 58.5 million acres of inventoried roadless areas in National Forest Service lands, National Forest System lands. Has the 2001 Roadless Rule helped or hindered with wildfire mitigation efforts?
I suppose that's going to depend on your perspective, Senator.
Helped or hindered? Which one?
Well, I don't have a say in whether it helps or hindered. You know, I have to...
But you don't... Maybe, regardless of what you do, does it? Describe it. In your assessment, has it helped or hindered wildfire mitigation efforts?
Well, I don't think it was designed to help wildfire mitigation, sir.
Understood.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The generosity that we've seen from our individual members, from individuals, ranchers, and even folks who aren't in ranching from across the country, and then even from corporations and companies. There's just been such an outpouring of support. It's been really amazing. The fund raised over, or we've collected in donations, over $1.3 million. So I think that's really a testament to the ranching community in Texas and across the United States.
Melissa Hamilton's with the Texas Southwestern Cattle Raisers.
This is not something that you're able to recover from in 1 year or 2 years. This is a multi-year recovery. And, you know, for some folks, especially with all they've been dealing with droughts and things like that, this is just one setback too many, and it can cause folks to leave ranching forever.